From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a left-leaning USA Today political columnist and CNN commentator decided to take a break. Kirsten Powers didn't like how it felt spending so much time on Twitter. She said everything seemed dark, explosive, venomous, so she spent several weeks off, and then she came back to share what she had learned. Powers wrote, via Twitter, quote, "I've spent the last few weeks in a mostly Twitter-free zone to spend time reflecting on what role I may have played in what indisputably has become a dangerously toxic culture. I am not proud of what I have found. I work hard to see every side of an issue and also speak up when I see a wrong. But in doing that, I am too often judgmental and condemning, both on and off social media, in a way that is contrary to my belief system and my faith. I want to stand on the side of justice and equality, but also of grace, and I have failed to do that," end quote. Powers goes on to say that she doesn't want to be part of call-out culture anymore. She wants to work towards justice, yes, while allowing for mistakes and growth, and she seems to be questioning whether that's even possible on Twitter. Well, is Twitter irredeemably flawed? Can we improve the platform, or at least our standards for interacting with it? Just yesterday on this program, a professor of philosophy talked about how she really doesn't use social media because she doesn't think it's a constructive place to have discourse. I don't know. Maybe Twitter's getting an unfair rap here. Maybe it's actually pretty cool. I think it's all right. Let's talk about it this hour. It's good to have some colleagues of ours here at WXXI, Veronica Volk, who also, I think, recently tweeted. Our reporter and producer at WXXI News recently tweeted that you're spending less time on Twitter.
That's right. I did. And I feel pretty basic about it, but we'll get into that.
Okay. Thank you for being here. Mona Isler, executive assistant, liaison to the board for WXXI, and I always enjoy your tweets. I'm glad you're on Twitter.
Thank you. I love Twitter.
Okay. See, we got a defender here.
Of course.
All right. And another defender, I think, is Emily Hesney Lynch, director of content at iHeartRock and a freelance social media strategist. A defender of Twitter?
Certainly, yes.
All right. Well, it's great to have you. In fact, I think you tweeted today it's your favorite social media platform out of all of them.
It is. Yeah. I can talk a little bit about why as we get into it.
Okay. So there's a lot to break down here. And listeners, if you want to follow along, you can tweet at us. This hour. At Evan Dawson on Twitter. Producer Megan Mack is there at MMack Media. Let me just kind of go around the table. I read a little bit of what Kirsten Powers was saying, and I thought that was a very open and introspective thing to say. Veronica Volk, how did you feel about not only what she said, but what she says has become a dangerously toxic culture?
I think it's just worth pointing out that, you and I have had some offline conversations about whether or not Twitter is influencing public discourse and how it does that and what we as journalists, what role we play in the continuing of those conversations. For instance, when you're a journalist and you see something trending, are you covering that story? Are you continuing the conversation, or are you jumping on like outrage bandwagons, which we've had a lot of productive conversations about and we can talk about more. Honestly, I understand the idea of stepping back from Twitter a little bit, particularly as a journalist, because, you know, we have to remain as objective as possible, and we're responsible for disseminating information. And doing so on Twitter, it can be a little bit challenging, particularly when you're not getting the full story in, you know, however many characters it is these days, 280 maybe. So it's important, I think, it was important for me to kind of step back, look at why I was using the medium, look at the, you know, the power and the influence that I had while I was using it, and maybe redefine why I used it.
Okay, are you going to tweet less?
I'm not sure. I think I might change a little bit of how I use the medium. I'm kind of like going through that now.
You're going to work through it this hour.
Yeah, no, I used to tweet a lot, right? I mean, like if you've been on my Twitter, at Volk Veronica, you will see that I tweet a lot. And most of it is just kind of reactions to other things that I'm seeing on Twitter.
Cat videos.
That becomes mostly cat videos, let's be totally honest, yeah. Which I think is, you know, it's an argument for the wholesome side of that medium, which is that there are pockets of Twitter that are really fun and funny and like people can come together and bond over content that they love. But also as a journalist, it's important to recognize when you are picking up dissenting opinions on Twitter that might not actually exist in the real world, mm-hmm. when you are engaging in, you know, constant outrage and call out culture, as was so adequately put in that article, because you want to be fair to the people in your own audience and in your own Twitter bubble, and you also want to be fair to the subject at hand. And there's a lot of times when things get kind of boiled down to their simplest and often a little bit misleading, words.
Okay. So. Mona Isler, what do you make of Kirsten Power saying that it's an undeniably toxic culture on Twitter? Is that too strong for you?
Sorry. No. But I also think that Twitter is what you make of it. I design my own Twitter. I follow the voices that I want to follow. And I can't necessarily help who follows me, which I encourage. Thank you all for following me, my 2,100 and however many followers I have.
What's your handle?
At, oh, goodness.
You don't have to say it if you don't want to.
Well, I tweeted about it, so I guess I should. It's at shopaholic_918. Feel free to follow me. I'm great.
She is, actually.
Twitter is by design. I follow who I want to follow. Now, other people that I follow are going to amplify things into my timeline mm-hmm. that I can choose to ignore or engage with or whatever. But the toxic nature of somebody like a Kristen Powers who has very specific thoughts and ideas, and there are people out there who completely disagree 100%, and so it's going to invite venom and response and all that stuff. And the more followers you have, the more likely you are to have a toxic environment or surrounding you in your Twitter. I don't find that to be the case for me, mostly because I can block whoever I want and dismiss
it. Block liberally.
I block liberally. Well, I'm mute mostly because I don't necessarily want my Twitter experience to be like that. I have found that Twitter is the best place to have good customer service experiences. I've made friends in real life, people that I met on Twitter who have translated into real life, strong, bonded friendships. So for me, it's not toxic for me, but that doesn't mean it's not toxic for other people.
Okay. Emily has new line. Go ahead, V.
Sorry, I was going to jump in. Evan, I'm going to.
I got to call you Veronica on the show. I just called you V. Sorry about that.
Sorry, it's Veronica Volk. At Volk Veronica. I think that Mona brings up a really interesting point, which is that like for the user, there is a different experience than maybe for the culture. Because when you are a user of Twitter, you can design your own social circles. But when you are a user on Twitter, you are also influencing other, parts of the culture by engaging in those conversations. So I think that's really just interesting way of kind of breaking it down. Like, I'm doing okay, right? But like, what does it mean for the rest of the world? What does it mean for our political environments? What does it mean for our communities?
I have a friend, Oliver Willis, who's got 100,000 followers.
You know Oliver Willis?
Oliver Willis and I are very close friends.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, see.
Okay.
We met on Twitter.
Oh.
And we know each other in real life.
Like, I see. Okay, yeah.
We have a very strong...
He has strong opinions.
He has very strong opinions.
Yes, he does.
And when I first met Oliver, he had 2,000 followers, maybe. He has now 120-some-odd thousand followers. He's got a... he used to work for Media Matters for America. So he's very strongly here. And we had a conversation on Twitter today about this topic.
People can't see your hands. You were pointing to the left.
I was pointing to the left.
Okay, yeah.
We had a conversation about this just on Twitter about this very topic. And I asked him, he says it's very toxic. He's doing his best. He's breaking away. He's trying to use it less. He doesn't go on it on the weekends because it is a venomous place. I asked him if he had that same experience when he only had 2,000 followers or 10,000 followers. And he said it wasn't as bad, but then he didn't have as many people to deal with. I mean, he is a person who pushes conversation. He tweets something, and if he tweets me, I get a massive amount of tweets and retweets, and I'm no one.
RIP my mentions.
Yeah. I mean, my yes. Exactly, because he's an influencer. So people who are influencers do find it to be toxic and ugly because, that's what happens when you influence people.
Okay, Emily Hesney Lynch, how do you feel about the possible toxic side of Twitter, and how do you avoid it?
I was going to kind of echo what Mona was saying about creating your own experience. So I have a couple tactics that I use to keep my Twitter experience the way I want it. I never follow more than 300 accounts at a time because I don't want to spend too much time on the platform, and I want to really limit what I'm inhaling off my feed. And I also use the mute function pretty liberally. So if someone's getting on my nerves, if someone's boring me, but I don't want to unfollow them or block them, I'll just mute them for a week and they pop back in my feed a week later. And that's great. So I feel like I can avoid a lot of the toxicity that way.
Do you think that this is a platform, though, that is sort of inevitably flawed? In other words, is it designed in a way that just creates social velocity in a negative direction, that things pick up speed, or are we sort of working through how we use different platforms, Emily?
I think the latter more than the former. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it can be blamed more on the current climate politically and culturally overall than on Twitter itself. Twitter is a place to have those conversations, but I don't think it's Twitter's fault that they're being had or how people are having them. I think we need to figure out how to have them productively and constructively.
I had a friend who recently said, don't judge anything in the era of Trump. Everything seems off. You know, like everything seems frayed. And
or you could make the argument that, you know, social media platforms gave birth to the rise of Trump and other political.
There's something to that.
Other political leaders that are kind of in that vein that almost feed on that outrage. And that kind of, you know, they have catchy slogans that, you know, trend on social media. And there's, you know, it's argued that Donald Trump, even in his campaign, was a media mastermind in the way that he was able to constantly capture the news's attention. And I think that translated really well in Twitter, like for his campaign anyway, just objectively speaking.
Don't worry, the journalists have learned so much.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely won't see a repeat of that this time, right?
No, probably not. There's something shiny. So there's a number of comments that I want to play before we kind of dive into some other directions here as we talk about whether Twitter is a valuable medium at all. And I happen to agree, by the way, with our guests who are identifying where they think the positive attributes are. I really enjoy the engagement. Rochester's got a wonderful sort of Twitter rock is great. Mm-hmm. There's some wonderful people. I agree with Mona Isler. I've met some people in real life who I first interacted with online. I'm looking at one of them across the table, and Emily Hesney Lynch, among others. So, and we also get a lot of good ideas and feedback and really thoughtful ideas for this talk show from a community that engages with us and does so during noon to two in real time. So there's real value there for us. But I also understand the critiques. Let's listen to some of it. I want to start with the last one there, Rob, which is recently on the Ezra Klein Show. Ezra Klein was the founder of Vox Media, and he has a podcast. And he, Ezra, in his younger days, actually in his early 20s, he was blogging occasionally on Andrew Sullivan's site. Now, back in the blog days, remember blogs? It was like, they were like a thing. Yeah, I know. Veronica, you're too young. But let me explain. Andrew Sullivan was one of the most popular bloggers who ever had a daily blog, or really an hourly blog, The Daily Dish. And he occasionally would have guest bloggers. Ezra is one of them. Now, Ezra is more politically left than Sullivan, who was a conservative who was also an Obama voter. But Ezra feels like Andrew has been kind of increasingly missing the point. So they got together on the podcast, and the part that was really interesting to me was their breakdown of how things have changed with who we are writing for. Bloggers used to write to try to counter a point and make a point. So if Mona writes something and I'm like, I don't think what you're writing on your blog makes any sense, I may break it down paragraph by paragraph, hoping you're going to read that and we're going to engage. Their belief now is we are posting to get applause from our own audience to sort of to dunk on people instead of actually advance the discourse. Let's listen to how they describe it.
I just remember those days, those early blogging days, as so much better than they are now, than things are now. I mean, I know I'm being nostalgic, but I think you wrote something the other day about the generosity of the links that you would make, the actual attempt to actually produce a counter argument that was addressing in good faith the arguments of the other side. That really did happen.
It wasn't nice. You know, I was thinking about this the other day because I think people get caught up on ideas of civility a bit. Blogging wasn't nice. People were fisking, right? Weren't you the one who came up with the word fisking?
Yep.
Like, people are it's like, here's a paragraph, and then you're like cutting it to shreds, and here's another paragraph, and why they're so wrong. But it had this quality, I think, because of the link ecosystem, that you wrote expecting to be read and replied to by the person you were writing about, and also because it was small. And the thing I often see now is that nobody writes as if they expect the person they're talking about to read them. And on Twitter in particular, it's like it's for your people, not their people. And I do think that changes the nature of the discourse. I also have this, you know, and I feel like I talk about it a little bit ad nauseum on the show, this nostalgia for where things were 10 years ago. And I don't know. Like, I do think it was better.
Yeah, I do, too. But I think there's something inevitable about the pace of online media that. I felt during the Dish for 15 years that in the last five of them, I could feel the pace picking up even within blogging.
All right. I think that's interesting. And I want to ask all of you about that. Do you agree with the idea that a lot of, at least the political stuff, and Twitter and social media do a lot of different things, but on the political side or the kind of the public discourse about issues, it's much more about dunking on someone and sort of getting applause from your followers as opposed to engaging? Yes or no, Mona?
I completely agree. I believe that, in my perspective, political Twitter is as siloed as Fox News and MSNBC. You follow and listen to the people who think the way you do, and you completely dismiss the thoughts and ideas of everybody else that you don't want to hear from. It used to be, I mean, I've been on Twitter for 9 years or so, and, you know, we made it a point to have people who thought differently than us in our feed. We wanted to have counter ideas to what we wanted to hear the other side. We wanted a different perspective. And nowadays, we very rarely let alternate views in because it's too hard. It's just going to lead to an argument. You're going to lose friendships. You're going to, you know, it's going to become ad hominem in a minute. You know what I mean? It starts out, I don't agree. And then next thing you know, you're cursing each other out and fighting and blocking each other. But today's now, it's just easier not to even listen to what's happening on the other side because it's just they're all lies. Everybody, you know, that's just how, from my perspective, how it is at this point.
Okay. Emily?
I think a prime example of this is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Today is the newest shiny thing on Twitter, and she's dunking on everyone, and people are loving it. But liberals are loving it. She's not going to convince anyone on the right to follow along with her and enjoy these dunks. Like, she's just doing it to kind of grow her own fan base and supporters. It's pretty one-sided in that regard.
You don't think that she is using the medium effectively? Well, she's using the medium effectively for her own sort of
sure
followers?
But I don't know that it's necessarily advancing the discourse. I think people are learning a little bit more about her platform and her beliefs and researching things they might not otherwise, but people who already agree with her are doing that.
Okay. Veronica?
First of all, I just want to say that the idea of being nostalgic for 10 years ago internet just really grinds my gears. It really does. I'm a big believer in the fact that we have to work within the system that is available to us. And if it wasn't Twitter, it would be something else.
To somebody, that's so true. We can talk about, well, we throw Twitter out. Well, there's something else that's going to be immediate.
Well, not only that, I mean, like, you know, not only would we be throwing Twitter out, which we can't do, but if you back away from Twitter, if, like, you and I, Evan, back away from Twitter, we're just leaving a void for other people to maybe propagate misinformation to the people who are going to stay on Twitter, right? And I mean, like, as journalists, if we want to, you know, exist in this, like, you know, social media environment, I think we have to play by the rules that we're given, do the best we can to, like, use the medium responsibly and, you know, inform people of, like, the realities of their community.
I'm going to push back in a way that I'm not sure I believe in.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready.
I think there is space for an argument to be made, and I don't know if I can make it, that says we don't have to engage in Twitter, even if people do stay on and believe that stuff, because what we can do instead is create sort of a social ridicule for people who spend too much time on social media because it's a bad or toxic place, in the same way that I don't read or write for National Enquirer, and I know certain people pick it up and be like, yeah, did you know that actually Hillary Clinton has two heads? And, you know, I can't change their mind, but I'm not going to be like, well, in good faith, I'm going to try to engage with that. To some degree, you can decide that's too far gone. We're going to let this go. I'm going to spend less time there, and we're going to create a social price for people who spend too much time in certain places.
I hear what you're saying. However, you just equated National Enquirer to Twitter. Twitter is a social platform. It's pervasive.
And actually, I probably did the president's work there because that implies that Twitter is fake news, and it's not always.
No, of course.
It's usually not.
Again, it's a platform. It's a medium. It's a meeting space.
Yeah.
And it's not the same as a single publication.
That's fair.
There are many people engaging in many different things and topics on Twitter, and I think that, you know, there is space for people to use it responsibly. Not everyone is going to. I mean, people are going to tweet headlines of articles they didn't read with reactions that are overdramatic, and we're going to have to deal with that on a social level. But I don't think that the answer is leaving, necessarily.
Go ahead, Mona.
I just want to kind of think about, or ask you to think about and consider that, in the same way that if you poll Americans and say, what do you think about Congress? And everyone will say, Congress is awful. They're not doing their jobs. They've got a 30% approval rating. But I love my Congress. And I think that there are people who are engaging in Twitter on this sort of national news, I hate this person and I hate that person, but locally they respond and deal with their local news Twitter, mm-hmm. their local arts and cultural things that are happening. They deal with that in a completely separate way than they do with whatever Kamala Harris is tweeting about, or the president, or whatever. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point.
So I think it's people are still creating an environment that it's still being used purposefully. I'm never going to, I want to hear what is happening locally in my news. I'm using Twitter. I follow people in my own local community just for that reason, just because I know that this is a place to share information, to learn things about what's happening where I live. But I'm also going to trash talk the president in the next tweet.
Right. And we haven't even gotten to like I Heart Rock yet, but I think that's like a super great example of ways that Twitter works on a local level and why, you know, why on some, in some regards, like I feel like I'll never actually leave.
Well, that probably is nice to hear.
It is very nice to hear. It's totally
thanks
trick.
For the flattery, Veronica.
But when it comes to the Mona's point on distinguishing between some of the national noise and the toxicity, but also the local community that can form, do you see that too?
Oh, totally. Yeah. You were talking, Mona, about friendships that you've made on Twitter, and I have friendships locally. I've never met some of these people in real life. Some of them I have, but I consider them very close friends. Some people locally through Twitter, I got a job, the job I currently have, which was kind of crazy. And there were people I invited to my wedding that I originally met on Twitter. I think these like local friendships in your Twitter bubble can be very real and very meaningful.
I want to listen to now some comments that were made by Trevor Noah last night, host of The Daily Show. And this is where I think the conversation about Twitter, because I'm going to follow Veronica Volk's lead and agree and say, you know, it's not, no one's going to leave this thing behind, because for a lot of the reasons that Veronica has already stated very well. But I do think journalists have got to be careful. And that's obvious. I mean, journalists always have to be careful. But the immediacy is really tempting. And inevitably, the most annoying thing has happened in the last week, week and a half with this Jesse Smollett case, which now looks like an orchestrated hoax, which is that I think some members of the media were very quick off with the story. Not all, some. But now that it looks like a hoax, you've got a bunch of people who are going to disbelieve that there's actual racism, violent racism, which is happening. I mean, there's a story. Look at the story that the Democrat and Chronicle posted this afternoon with a Rochester connection to what happened in Boston. There is all kinds of hate and, unfortunately, violence that does happen, but people are less likely to believe it because they'll say, well, the big story was a hoax. And this is where I think Trevor Noah makes an important point for everybody, reporters especially, but for everybody. Let's listen.
I do know if I was Trump, this is a home run in my world. Because so many people jumped on board before they even like waited to see what it was about. They're like, just like, I don't know. We live in a world where people are too enthusiastic at jumping at stories that confirm their biases. And instead of just pausing and going, what do I make of the story? What do I make of this story? Of my own volition, forget your political anythings. You know, this is like, does it confirm your biases? That's when I always think you have to be even more vigilant. Is when it confirms everything you've believed. And this goes for both sides of people, with like, because Trump supporters are in the deepest conspiracies ever. It's not like anyone's immune to this. But I think increasingly since Trump has come into power, people have become increasingly willing to accept any story that confirms anything about a Trump supporter or Trump or a white person. Or it's just like, and I always go like, do not become the thing that you disdain. Do not become the thing that you hate, because then what are you fighting for if you've become the thing that you're trying to fight against?
I think that's an admonition for reporters, too. What do you think, Veronica?
I think it applies specifically to reporters. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about confirmation bias for years. It's just this idea that as kind of information gatekeepers and you know, the disseminators of information, journalists have to stop jumping on the bandwagon and quote tweeting, you know, crazy stories, or they have to do their part to be vigilant in the information that they are responsible for sharing to their audiences and also contributing to the conversation at large.
Okay. Emily, what do you make of what you just heard there from Trevor Noah?
I thought he had some really interesting points, and one thing that just came to mind, Ocasio-Cortez
Cortez.
Ocasio-Cortez again. Before she dunks on anyone on Twitter, she will only dunk on a verified account. She always does her research to make sure it's a real person and it's not just a troll. And she's super careful, like, about what messages she's amplifying. So I think that applies both to journalists and to everyday humans on Twitter, to just be careful and do your research before you push things up into other people's feeds even more.
Okay. Mona?
Oh, I believed him, because why would I not believe... Why would I hear that someone, despite the fact that he's an actor, has nothing to do with it, that someone was attacked and was injured? The MAGA stuff aside, that's not, you know, my instinct was to believe, you know, oh my goodness, that's awful. How
he had like a cut on his face.
Right. How awful for him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's terrible. I'm not making any swift judgments about anybody. I'm having sympathy for a victim. Mm-hmm. And then as the story unfolds... I literally still don't know what to believe. Honestly, I don't. I have zero amount of trust for Chicago PD. So, and I'm being completely honest, because we've just spent the last several years talking about how much they lied about Laquan McDonald. So I can't necessarily give them the benefit of the doubt, mm-hmm. you know. But I do believe that most of the time for me, my instinct is to respond, to be sympathetic to the victim. I'm not passing judgment. I'm not saying who did what wrong, but so my instinct is to deal with, oh my goodness, let me give some sympathy for the victim or empathy for whoever is going through this, mm-hmm. and then let the rest of it play out. But I'm not in a position to, you know, amplify a story to, you know, make it bigger than what it is. I'm simply responding to what I am being shown
by reporters
and everyone else, yeah. because mm-hmm. you know, once it happens, it happens. But so.
Well, when you talk about confirmation bias with a story like that, I mean, you have a story that who knows what actually happened, right? But what do you think about when you see it? Does it play into your, you know, beliefs about violence in communities? Or the question that I'm trying to get to is, what is the value of that story to people who are outside of that situation? And we see stories on Twitter all the time be amplified to the point of getting national attention because they play into people's beliefs and values about race in America, about violence and about police violence and about, you know, a million different other very politically and socially charged issues. And what is the value of this one story to people across the country? And should we be exposed to it?
Well, initially for me, the value of the story is how unprotected young gay men are, mm-hmm. and especially young gay men of color, mm-hmm. and that violence against them, a violence against trans women and trans men, is pervasive in this country, and people don't realize it, or people choose to ignore it because it's not happening to their neighbor and it's not happening on their street. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the fact that there is a story that is amplified to the national level helps bring to the forefront that these things are existing. People in Nebraska need to recognize that this is happening in Pittsburgh or Philly or Chicago or wherever it's happening. That's my initial reaction is, it's awful that these things are happening, but maybe someone will see that violence against people of color and people who are gay or whatever has increased. Violence by Caucasians has increased in the Trump era. At least maybe that's the confirmation bias, because I truly believe that. And so if I see a story, well, then that just sort of...
That's what I'm saying.
It confirms, but I still believe it.
Absolutely. I totally hear you. I'm just saying that Twitter is designed for that one thing to happen. And then when people are constantly confirmed, and I'm not saying that any of your biases are untrue,
right.
but I am saying that they're biases. And like in different circles on Twitter, in different bubbles, you see those different biases be constantly confirmed and confirmed and confirmed and validated. And, you know, I think that we have to be careful and check against that, especially like with this particular story where it turns out it might have been a hoax. What is that going to do to the message that it was telling you?
Right. The disservice that it does.
Sure.
So that, like Evan said, now people can go the next time someone actually is attacked.
They're going to say, yeah, right.
They're going to say, well, you know, sure. You're probably a hoax just like that. You know, that Chicago right. guy, that Empire guy.
And where's the substance? Let's talk about violence against people in LGBT communities. Let's talk about violence against people of color in a substantive way,
right.
which Twitter is not able to do. I mean, like, how are you going to point out stats and facts and figures and like a stream of cat videos and
thread.
Outrage?
Thread.
thread. You're the master of the thread, Evan Dawson.
I know. You think my threads are too long.
Veronica, they're too long.
What should be the maximum number of tweets in a thread?
Three.
Five.
Oh, come on. Three is way
25.
Too short.
25.
No. 25 is too many. I've seen a 60-tweet thread. I was done at 13, I'm pretty sure.
After three, I'm done. I don't have this much time. Otherwise, I wouldn't be on Twitter.
I'm going to give you 10. Because that's a decent paragraph.
You can
paragraph.
Read it. You can read it.
You get 10 and that's
You're saying 10, Emily?
Five.
Oh, I'm man. Patient.
I got to redo how I do the whole thread thing. Tom writes to us, and pretty good point here. Tom says, Andrew Sullivan waxes nostalgic about the early days of his blogging and how generous everyone is. But here is something he, in the second year he was blogging about, he wrote about the middle part of the country, the great red zone that voted for Bush, is clearly ready for war. The decadent left in its enclaves on the coast is not dead and may well mount what amounts to a fifth column. How civil is that? All this talk about incivility of Twitter ignores the utter insanity of mainstream media in the late 90s and early 00s. I'd like an example of something that's caught on Twitter that's as toxic and genuinely stupid as the way the established media covered the run-up to the Iraq War and the early days of the war. The fawning coverage of George W. Bush's mission accomplished speech makes all of today's Twitter look like a high-information League of Women Voters debate. So, okay. Tom's making a point here that, you know, it's always easy to look back and be like, you know what was better? Dot matrix printers. You know, they made
nostalgia.
You really made you be patient and wait and have a whole cup of coffee before something was printed.
It's a dangerous thing.
Yeah. Tom, thank you. It's a fair point. It wasn't always perfectly civil. I'm pretty sure in the Revolutionary War days, it wasn't always civil in what was written in paper. So incivility has always existed. The question is, does the velocity it takes on a platform like Twitter make it sort of all-consuming? And again, I think our guests are pushing back a little, but let's get our only break of the hour and we'll take some of your feedback. So 844-295-TALK if you want to weigh in. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Mona Isler, Executive Assistant and Liaison to the Board for WXXI at Shopaholic underscore
918.
So there's Mona. Veronica Volk is at Volk Veronica. Is that right?
Yep.
She's a reporter and producer, as you know, for WXXI News. Emily Hesney Lynch is director of content at iHeartRock, a freelance social media strategist at ServeMeTheSky on Twitter. The sky is delicious. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections. If you heard all about the tax cuts, the federal tax cuts in the last year, but then you're getting your tax bill and it's not what you expected, you're not alone. We take a look at the reality of where our taxes are under this new system in our first hour. Then in our second hour, a conversation about how language changes over time. What does woke even mean? Has it changed already? We take a look.
Martin Luther King Jr. came to embody the ideal of peaceful, nonviolent protest. So how did he handle his anger?
He came very dangerously close at that particular time to hating all white people.
I'm Ari Shapiro, turning anger into positive action. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. Let me go ahead and let me get one quick phone call before we continue our discussion. John in Rochester has been waiting. A former Twitter employee, John?
Hello.
Yeah, did you work for Twitter? Is that right?
I did. I did. I worked for them for 5 years until the middle of last year.
How was that?
And it was a great experience. I worked with a lot of really wonderful people, and I learned more in that 5 years than I did in the preceding 25 years of my work life. Hmm. So it was great. I had some comments on sort of the general discussion. I feel like the toxicity that people see on Twitter, I mean, it is unfortunate, and it's a kind of a result of the, you know, there's no moderation or anything. But I also feel like it's a reflection of our culture. People may find it shocking that there are Nazis on Twitter, but guess what? There's Nazis in your state or your county or whatever, and maybe you didn't know that before. So maybe it's better that you know than you live in ignorance of the presence of these people. The other thing I'd like to say that Twitter, I think, was born out of idealism and maybe a little bit naive in its inception. Whereas, you know, it's so easy to create an account, and it may be too easy to create an account. And there's no requirement to prove your identity or anything like that. It makes it easy to hide behind an anonymous account and throw rocks at people. But I feel like that's, they didn't design it to be a toxic stew. They designed it, you know, with a sort of idealistic concept that anybody could do this, anybody could get on, everybody has a voice, you know?
Yeah, I mean, anybody can complain directly to a brand and have recourse immediately. In some ways. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, no, that's one of the great things about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a double-edged sword. And the other little technical thing I wanted to mention is that people should definitely go to their notifications tab in the Twitter application and tap on that little gear. And there are a whole bunch of ways of filtering the notifications you get that will reduce to, if you're getting a lot of unwanted stuff in your notifications, it will tune it down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of options there. And so if you're somebody who's getting a lot of attention, unwanted attention, it's easier than like muting individual accounts. If they're, you know, if it's just like a random person making a terrible comment at you.
John, let me just jump in and say, first of all, thank you for the phone call. And I think John's right. I mean, this was designed with all kinds of potential. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to respond to Soup Girl on Twitter, who says, Evan Dawson on WXXI Rochester talking about how bad Twitter is just made me want to go on Twitter more. Well, listen, Soup Girl. We criticize because we love.
I've
I think the platform's
Twitter this
important.
Entire time.
Listen, he's made a really good point, and there's an important point to be made about Twitter fingers. Twitter fingers is when you can sit behind your keyboard, your phone, or whatever, and say whatever you want to say, but you would never deign to say what you're saying in my face. So there is this, you know, people get bold behind the keyboard.
Yeah.
Where they wouldn't in real life. But he also makes a great point is, I'm glad to know that if it's, especially if it's somebody that I can identify, who thinks the way that they think. It was important, and I'm just saying this as a woman of color, it was important when people actually had the masks on, because then we could identify who was our enemy, who we should be afraid of, who we should hide from. When the masks came off and got put in a different way, then that's when we became fearful, because now I don't know who to believe. I don't know who to trust. I don't know who is after me, or, you know what I'm, am
right.
I making any sense?
Yes.
So he makes a good point that sometimes it's good to know who your enemies are, who's mm-hmm. crazy, who's a complete lunatic, who's, you know, completely nuts. But also
who's telling on themselves, as Twitter would say.
Right. Yeah. But it's also important to know that a lot of people that are saying all this stuff, creating this toxic environment, would never, ever to step to me, you know, and say the things that they want us, that they would say in my mentions.
I'm not sure. I feel like it's emboldened people in their unpopular opinions by giving them a community and kind of an outlet. And also, I mean, look, I could give you like a 20-minute dissertation on media ecology, but I think that it's a basically an understood fact that digital media in general and social media in particular, they do shape culture. It's not just a reflection of the culture. It changes the way that we interact with each other and we talk to each other. So when I say that, and also I say this as a white woman, being, you know, exposed to a lot of different opinions and a lot of like very outrageous, in my opinion, opinions. It seems to me that people are meeting in these spaces, and that translates like in real life. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would agree.
Well, one thing I think is, as much as you say that people are recreating the culture, as growing up, we'd say they just haven't run up on the right one yet. Because there are people who think that they can actually step away from Twitter and behave in the way that they do in real life. And sometimes they get away with it. They just haven't run up on the right one yet, which means there are people out there who are going to check that negative behavior if you were to ever try to do that in real life. And that's why my Twitter says I'm not the one. I didn't send for you. People know that they can't just come and talk absolute nonsense to me in the real world. Twitter knows it too. My people in the real world know it as well. But I also agree that Twitter has allowed for diverse voices to come together, for people to learn, to understand that the world is way different than the little bubble that we actually live in, even as a woman of color. And I'm intersectional, but I'm also learning things from people who are Native and people who are disabled, people who, you know what I mean? Twitter has allowed me to really learn a lot about the world that exists outside of my own reality.
And so let me just build on this point right here that Mona's making, because you make this point. Twitter's allowing you to experience and hear from and interact with people who are different. You also said earlier, though, politically, it's easy to just build your own silo. And the one thing that I do think, diversity of thought probably, I think it's, we got to be careful not to just build this Twitter biosphere that, you know, blocks out all other voices with different opinions. And because then we start thinking of them as the enemy. It's like a team sport. And that's what I do think Twitter encourages. And I want to listen to some of the comments from yesterday on this program from University of Rochester professor of philosophy, Zainab Soysol. And Zainab said she just doesn't really use social media because she doesn't feel it's a constructive place for discourse. It tends to have all of these shortcomings that isn't overcome in any meaningful way. And so this is some of what she had to say about Twitter and social media.
One thing to keep in mind is when you have certain conversations with people and it gets heated and you start to feel like they are the enemy, those conversations happen a lot online, for instance. When you don't even see the person, you don't have the feeling that you are speaking to another human being. You are also anonymous in some ways, like you don't have to show your face. So these tiny little things, I think, can exacerbate viewing people as enemies or as immoral in some ways where you don't even want to engage with them anymore.
I don't disagree with that, but what I'm actually sad about is I think all the good things and John's phone call about the potential of Twitter, I like engaging with people in a way that says, look, my mind's open to change here. Like, you can move me. Like, let's have this discourse. But I find that Twitter more often, when you do that, people are just not ready for that, and they don't expect that you're operating in good faith, so they just try to sort of fire back. And I see the good that Mona's talking about, experiencing and hearing from people who are different. But when it comes to diversity of thought, it feels like it's just a wasteland at times. I don't know how to get past that.
Politics in particular, because not...
So you're saying that's separate not to politics.
That is completely separate.
It's a huge part of it, Mona.
If politics is what you're on Twitter for, and not everybody... Remember, the number of people that are on Twitter does not have anything to do with the massive amount of people that exist in the world who don't deal with social media at all. But there are people who do not do any type of politics on Twitter at all. They're there because they want to meet up with people who knit. They want to share recipes. They do want to share cat videos. They want to experience a world. Now, sometimes politics get in, but not everyone is on Twitter for politics.
Right. But Twitter shapes politics. So what does it mean when you use that medium on a day-to-day basis? I mean, the platform itself shapes the conversation. People grab hot takes off Twitter and put them in an article that's covered by NBC News. Like, and this is
you're talking about journalists.
Totally.
I'm talking about real people.
I'm a real person, Mona. No, hear you. I totally hear you.
You see what I'm saying? So there is a perspective that I want, that I think it's important for journalists to keep that perspective. But I'm talking about the people that I follow that follow me that are just on it because we really do get emotional, strangely enough, I get a lot of emotional support from Twitter about whatever is going on in my life.
Yeah.
I almost gave up on Parks and Rec after 3 episodes, but Twitter said, no, doggone it, you hold still. You stay there. And now I'm 6 seasons in and I love it, right? So there are people who just talk about award shows, and this is what their experience is, and that's what they want.
There's a whole comedy genre of Twitter.
Right.
There's some brilliant people who can tweet in 140 or 280 characters, and I go, that is a work of art. That
a
is
work of art.
Brilliant.
I laugh a lot on Twitter that when I'm passing by the stuff about politics, and my friends are there. People that I'm engaged with, my friends are having babies and getting married, and some of them I've met in person, and some of them I've never seen. But what's happening in their life is important. Their kids are graduating from college. Their Twitter, my Twitter, is more excited when my daughter just applied to grad school than I was. So that that exists. That environment is there. Mm-hmm. Politics is important, and it's huge, but it's not all that the platform is.
Let me ask Emily Hesney Lynch to kind of weigh in on that, because I feel like when your dogs go off to college, I'm going to be just as excited for them, because I know your family, you know, through Twitter.
Yeah. No, I share a lot of personal stuff on Twitter. I don't just use it professionally. And I think it's helped me build a lot of relationships, and I really enjoy that aspect of it.
What do you say to cynics who don't use Twitter, and which doesn't always skew older? I mean, there's this idea that social media is for the young, but like looking at some of the stats that producer Megan Mack sent, where is this? What, you know, when it comes to American Twitter usage, only 6% of U.S. teens say Twitter is the most important social network. I mean, it's not number one.
No, but it's Instagram.
And Snapchat.
Snapchat's over, Evan.
Oh, it's over.
Sorry.
It's canceled.
It's canceled, and I never knew what it was.
Oh,
so there's,
okay.
There's that.
Okay. But bottom line being, what do you say to people who are cynics who say, you know, you can't build meaningful relationships? That's not real.
I think the fact that I got a job through Twitter is like a huge convincing thing. I met a girl on Twitter. We had been talking for a while. Someone tried to poach her from her job, and she said, oh, I'm not interested in that, but why don't you talk to Emily Hesney Lynch? And there it was. We had coffee. I got a job like 2 months later, all because of this one connection that I made on the internet. So
it's real.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me, before the hour is up here, I know, V, you wanted to press a little bit on.
Yes, Evan.
So
one of the things that
I was. Because I've been dodging this.
Throughout this entire conversation, I've been thinking about the fact that you are, we brought it up during, you know, before the break. You are the king of threads. You have a lot of takes. And I imagine that you are starting to feel a little bit differently about that. So I want to hear your hot take on hot takes.
I would like to tweet less and listen more.
You tweeted recently that I'm glad this is my first tweet about Smollett.
Yeah. I said the same thing about the Covington case.
Absolutely.
Because I feel like when really hot emotional stuff hits, my instinct in the past would be to at least share what we know, maybe add some perspective. But the world does not need that from me. And what I need is to pull back and listen more. And I have found that to be a more... a wiser approach than...
What do you mean, pull back and listen more?
Because in the case, you take the Smollett story. I'm with Mona. When I heard that story, I'm feeling bad for her. I'm going, this is it's amazing. My instinct is not to initially say hoax. My instinct is to say, like, especially if there's police photos and the guy's got a cut on his face and a puffy eye. I'm going, he got attacked. You know, looks real. But... let's wait till we get more context. That story is still going to be there in a day or two once we know more, once police investigate more, once we get more of a determination. So it wasn't even just like, well, I smell a hoax here. It was like, we can calm down because this is a very emotional story at a very emotionally charged time. We don't have to fire things off mm-hmm. in the first minutes here. We can wait. And okay. I find that to be generally wiser for me.
Thanks for letting me flip the script on this one. I appreciated it.
Sure. I will also say that Mona makes a really, you know, Mona's made some really powerful points just about who we follow, et cetera. And I try to actively choose to follow people who are way on. People sometimes talk about right, left, like it's a. Like, the media is left. The left is super diverse right now. The presidential election with 16 candidates or whatever has very interesting views that run from actual socialists to centrist Democrats. And it's very interesting to see the diversity on the left. There's diversity on the right, of course. There's diversity of thought all across this wide spectrum. And I do try to follow a wide, wide range, even when things annoy me, though you're not going to get me to follow. I'm not even going to mention any names because I don't want to. There are people who have retweeted me.
Come on.
And it's like 48 hours of RIP my mentions. Okay, when Laura Ingraham retweeted me once.
Oh, forget it.
It was like, I guess I won't be on social media for a while because, wow, it's fascinating what the people will say. But
Can I also just say, if you're listening to this and you're kind of overwhelmed by your Twitter feed, but you also want to tap into those different diversity of thought bubbles,
yeah.
TweetDeck is an awesome tool. You can create different lists that kind of center around different interests. So if you want to go on Twitter, but you only want to see your knitting Twitter, or you want to go on Twitter and you want to see like the diversity of, you know, the fight for democratic socialism. You can create lists that are really specific to those different nuanced conversations, and I think it's a really interesting way to experience Twitter.
I think it's a great point. There also are really thoughtful people who have political views. So let's say you're a Democrat. There are thoughtful conservatives who are really interesting on Twitter. Let's say you're a Republican. There are thoughtful progressives who are really interesting on Twitter. It's not all just the extremes and the cable news stuff. There's some really interesting thinkers and writers who will engage. Anybody who comes at me about anything, I try to respond. And I try to respond in a good faith way that sometimes catches people off guard, because that's where I think Andrew Sullivan was right. They're not even, and Ezra Klein was right, they're not even expecting a response anymore. People just fire off a tweet to sort of try to throw a barb or throw a punch.
It feels good in the moment. I mean, this is going to go back to a story I reported on a little while ago about rage rooms, but there's something about kind of immediately unleashing your anger that's can be seen as therapeutic, but it also spurs more anger in kind of the long term.
All right, so last minute, you're staying on Twitter, but you're going to
less? But I'm probably going to think about what I tweet a lot more and think about the way that it plays into the conversation at large.
100% though, dog and cat videos.
Always. Cats.
Cats for sure.
Cats for sure.
Emily Hesney Lynch.
One comment about owning what you say on Twitter. There's a podcast that I listen to called Conversations with People Who Hate Me. And the host, Dylan Marin, really encourages people to always remember that there's another person on the other side of the screen. So he'll bring two people together who have clashed online and moderate that conversation. So I think it's really important to own and stand by and be proud of what you're saying on the internet and to never tweet something that you're going to regret. So I've tried more and more to be thoughtful before I tweet. And sometimes I take to Twitter as a place to vent and sometimes I shouldn't. So it's a constant learning experience.
What's the name of that pod?
Conversations with People Who Hate Me.
Great recommendation. Mona, final thoughts.
I'm never leaving. I'm so addicted to Twitter. It's my favorite platform.
Are you addicted?
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. I am. I'm not leaving. And thanks to all my followers who are listening. You guys are the best.
Well, I really appreciate the conversation this hour. And again, for whether it was Soup Girl or whoever else was like, boy, Evan Dawson hates Twitter. I don't. I just want it to be better. And I want to be better. That's kind of why we're here. So, Mona Issler, great having you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Emily Hesney Lynch, thank you very much.
Thanks, Evan.
And Veronica Volk, thank you.
Thanks for letting me co-host the show today,
Evan. You are always welcome to co-host the show. Grab that microphone. Rob Braden is the engineer, who is very patient with me. And if Rob was less charitable, he would be on Twitter. I've been very annoying as a host today. Rob is very patient. Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.